Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 21, delivered on April 7, 2015. The title of this lecture is Common Stock.
Today, Common Stock. Common Stock is the representation of ownership in a corporation. When a corporation forms under state law, it declares a certain amount of capital stock into which the company's assets are divided. So, for example, in the Articles of Incorporation, I might say that the capital stock of this corporation is divided into 10 million shares, par value $0.001 per share, common. It's almost like I'm teaching you an ancient way of seeing something that really isn't how we see it anymore in modern finance. We talk about common stock being ownership in a corporation, and that's okay as far as it goes, but if I took you much further, I'd have to start explaining to you that common stock is nothing but a derivative, that the true pure security in a corporation is its debt. But I'm not going to get into that. We're going to pretend that doesn't exist, that that it's the way it always has been in our perspective. Look, when a company starts up, there are the Articles of Incorporation, and they go through a lot of the details, the business of this company is, the address of this company is, this is incorporated in such and such state, the service of process and all of that. And then there are usually some initial organizers. And when the articles are filed, it states right in the articles, the duties of the organizers are abolished or abandoned to the bylaws upon the filing of this document. Now, typically, the original owners will get some stock, each of them to represent their ownership in the corporation. And maybe a few thousand shares, maybe a few million, enough so that they can retain control of the corporation should they decide to sell some stock to others. If a company is a close corporation, I'm just testing you. Let's try that again. If a company is a closed corporation, that means that the common stock is not freely tradable. You can't just go out and sell your stock willy-nilly. The stock would be restricted under Rule 144. Of the Securities Act of 1933, or the Securities Act of Exchange Act of 1934, I should say. A lot of times we'll just say it's Rule 144 stock. And in the old days, when you got a physical stock certificate, there would be a red stamp on it, restricted. And that means that you could not have the stock transfer agent turn that into a share of stock for someone else. I cannot, you as my stock transfer agent, I can say, well, I've signed the back of the stock share. I've sold it to someone here. You issue them a new share and take care of this old one. And you would say, no, I can't do that. Restriction is applying, and it has to have the opinion of legal counsel before you can release that stock from restriction and issue a new share without the red letter on it. Now, if I am talking about a public corporation, I'm talking about an animal that has gone through some form of registration of stock of the company. That registration is generally via one of two mechanisms. Either an initial public offering, an IPO, where the company registers a block of stock to sell to the public. Or there is an alternate way, which is to register stock that is already in existence and is restricted. That is via Form 10. Now, either way that the company goes public, and technically, if you look at an IPO, the requirements for the production of documents for an IPO, there's actually a Form 10 kind of embedded within the IPO. Either way, once the company is public, the stock can be freely traded by the owners of it. They can trade it back and forth if there is an exchange that is listing the stock. But the downside is that the company then goes into the perpetual mill of reporting. It must report annually on Form 10-K. It's almost like the 10-Ks are amendments to the original Form 10. It must also file quarterly documents called the 10-Qs. These are massive undertakings, especially the 10-K. I did those as a consultant back when I was. It was legal for me to do this. And I mean, these things are 800-pound gorillas of reading material. You saw just a tiny hint of it in the financial statements I showed you on Edgar. You can have a look at a full Form 10 filing. It's a knock dead. There are other documents a company must file, too. For example, this is recurring. This is a recurring document. Talk about the recurring event of those sales and the costs of the company, the business activities that are in the normal course. The company also has to file 8-K. 8-K is a report on a non-recurring event. So if a director resigns, or the president of the company dies, or there is a press release that might affect the stock, some material event, you will see some companies just issue an 8-K for anything. Other companies are a little bit more parsimonious. You can see them in the Edgar filings of a company. They're right there. And there are other filings a company has to do, too. Now, as far as insiders go, like a president of the company might have stock that he has been issued as part of his compensation package. He cannot sell it at will. First, he must sell it only in windows that are available for such sales. He must get the opinion of counsel that it is okay to do this. And he must also, or he or she, must also make a filing on 14, I think it's Form 14, letting the public know that an insider has sold some stock. He can't sell more than a certain amount in any given window. If there is some significant event coming up, he can't sell the stock pending that it's significant event. So, for example, you could not have the president know that some bad news was coming out and he's in his window, so he sells some stock during the window. That would trigger all kinds of flags with the SEC. Although there are some glaring examples where owners of insider shares did do that and they didn't get in trouble. One of them was I wrote an article about it, in fact, about Dick Cheney when he was vice president and he was an owner in a company that had a very significant negative event, and he and his wife dumped stock right before the negative event. They never got in trouble, but don't you try that, because the SEC would probably throw you in the hoosegow. Also, a company that seeks to take a stake in another company, like I want to take over your company, so I start quietly buying stock, preparing for a proxy battle. Once I reach a certain threshold of ownership, I must file with the SEC that I am doing this. I have acquired a certain stake in the company. There are all kinds of filings. So going public is a real pain in the butt. So many companies, they were all excited about the idea of going public. We're going to get money from the public. We're going to sell stock in an IPO, and that will fund our operations and all that kind of great stuff. And it you'd have to sit down with these people and say, you don't understand. First of all, this is going to take quite a while to put the documents together and have them pass muster with the SEC. Second, once you've done this, for the rest of the company's life, which theoretically is eternity, you're going to have to make these filings and keep your eye on everything you do to make sure that it's all ready for that one big push on the 10Q every quarter and the monster push for the 10K every quarter, every year. And you can't be deceptive. You can't say, well, you're the consultant, you don't need to know this. Yes, I need to know everything about it. And so does everyone else in the ranks of the officers and directors of the company. Because ever since the scandals of the late 1990s and the early 2000s, there has been a law called Sarbanes-Oxley that has required that the officers and directors personally sign off on the veracity of the filings they make with the SEC that will be available to the public. Okay. Yeah. It is, but of course, then your means of getting money are much, much more difficult. That's the downside, is that as a on the upside, a private company, you don't answer to the SEC. Now, you're still going to answer to the state in a lot of forms. God knows, my company is a small, closely held S corporation, and it seems like literally every week I realize I've missed some filing and they're yelling at me and they're threatening me. So you're still going to have paperwork, but you're not going to have that layer of paperwork up there at the top of the food chain at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Upside, downside. Okay, now, either way, now, oh, by the way, I should mention this. During an IPO, you can also register stock that was issued previously that's Rule 144 stock so that it becomes more or less freely tradable but possibly still restricted. It depends on to whom you issued the stock. But sometimes in the initial public offering of a company, stock that was sold in private placements will be thrown in there too. Oh, by the way, we're registering this stock as well. And of course, that you have to take that into account in the pricing of the stock, because the public is going to buy that, but they're also going to realize that you are going to get your stock that you've had for a couple of years, maybe 5 years, registered, which waters down the power of their stock, and you're probably also going to start dumping your stock real fast if you can. And so I got to appreciate the fact that when I buy stock in an initial public offering, if stock of formerly restricted stock gets registered, that guy's probably going to want to cash in and buy himself a new car or something. So I got to be a little understanding that when I register that stock, the buyer, prospective buyers, are going to keep an eye on how much stock are you registering that's not going to earn you money right now. Public offering. I want to go through two ways that stock can be issued, can be sold. Stock can be sold. There is a private placement. The stock that originates from this will be restricted. And then there is a public offering, either the initial or a secondary. And many companies issue stock of more than once. But I'll talk about more like an IPO. Now, I did one full-blown 800-pound gorilla IPO in my consulting career. Most of what I did were private placements, or there is a, for lack of a better word, a trick. You can use a certain exemption from registration, but the stock that comes out of it is freely tradable. And I'll explain that one to you in a minute or two here. But understand that normally for your shareholders to be able to sell their stock, other people to buy it in the secondary market after it has been sold to the public, sold to people, you have to do some kind of a registration statement. The great big one is a Form S-1. That was the one I did. It is just an absolute nightmare. It's kind of like three parts. Well, it was back then. There was like this big reporting thing for the internal use of the SEC. And then there was this middle part, which is called the prospectus, that will eventually be what the selling document. In other words, the middle part of the Form S-1 filing is a selling document that will go out to the public when you're trying to actually sell the stock or when the underwriters are trying to sell the stock. And then the back part of it is just this mass of financial information, audited, certified, signed off on, the whole nine yards. Take that big wad together and you file it with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the Securities and Exchange Commission will look through it. And again, I've said this before and I'll say it again. No government agency of any kind ever approves any filing of any kind. The term is qualified. The SEC, you are seeking the qualification of the SEC to proceed with the IPO. Well, I filed my Form S-1 and on a fax machine just a few days later. They were fast with me. I got page after page after page of deficiencies. 497 deficiencies in my filing. And I thought, I called this old lawyer. He was out of the business, but he was really helpful to me. I got 497 deficiencies on the first filing. Well, that's not bad. Not bad. What? So I burned the midnight oil, calling the executives. Let's get this in order. Let's get that in order. Let's tell me what I... Anyway, filed again. Came down to six deficiencies on the second round, which was, I was stunned. A lot of it was just my stupidity, thinking I knew what I was doing because I had me a college degree and all that. Well, I got my ass kicked. But on the second one, I got smart fast. I got six. Those were a little harder. Not all of them. Several of them were just I had missed something that they told me the first time. Went through it again, and then I got a fax. I remember it was on a Thursday afternoon, the the initial public offering on Form S-1 has been qualified. Oh God, I treated myself to so many cheeseburgers that night. Seriously, I remember there was a place in Columbus called TJ's, and I just stuffed myself all night until I vomited. Okay, Form S-1, I had done it. I had pulled it. Well, then... Next comes the next part is that there's a quiet period that's going to have to happen with it. You can't be blabbing around, wow, we got a stock offering going on here. What comes next is that you pull out that middle part, which is the prospectus. And then at first, you print it with red lettering on the front. And hence it has earned the name over many, many, many decades, red herring. It cannot be used to sell the stock, but it can be passed around to show to potential buyers, to show to a possible underwriter, but it cannot be used to sell stock. You can't do that during the quiet period. There will be a drop-dead date when the offering opens. During that quiet period, you can move that red herring around and kind of like, you got to be careful. You can't just leave it on table for people to look at and all that. But it's there as sort of a pre-selling sort of agreement. Go. No, the red herring is a prospectus. It tells about the company, the inside, all the information about the company's business, the company's prospects. You have to include pro forma financial statements projecting what the company's going to do. The higher the quality of the document, the more likely you are to get the attention of rich people and possibly even an underwriter or two.
But can it include financial statements?
Oh, it has to. Everything. Yeah, the red herring does not include all of the stuff that's in the Form S-1 filing. Even in financial statements. But it does include a lot of the information there. And it includes also projections. It's a real live document that the better you make it, the more you show that you are trying to project accurately. You're trying to be honest about the prospects of the company. The more likely you are to find investors who are willing to have a look at it. Yeah. You don't have to.
Okay, you should.
Yeah, I mean, if I saw you coming in, I'd say, no, you're ugly. And that's another thing, too, is that sometimes, and that's one of the things, you do want to control that red herring. And this comes to me from some of the old dogs that used to help me, that helped me become better in the business. They said, you know, you got this stack of red herrings that you ordered from the printer. Well, you're not going to hand those out because there are some people you don't want to have them. Like who? Like maybe competitors. You might not want some competitor that's a private company to see the inside operations of your company this quickly because they get a jump on you by seeing all this. They don't have to make these disclosures. They can be all secretive about everything they do. Your prospectus turns you into a naked person. Everyone can see everything, and it ain't pretty. So some of you even ain't prettier than others, sir. But anyway, you understand that by going public, you are literally, here I am. All you companies that are staying private and can hide your information and keep yourselves all secretive, well, now you got the jump on me. So I'm probably not going to hand out that red herring to some. I know eventually they're going to get it when it goes out of, goes to the offering's start date. But, you know, why give them some advantage on time with it, too? There are other... Oh, I also want to point out that back in the day, and they're still around, although it's interesting that you were going to have a hard time finding them, if you do a Google image search, you'll be amazed at how difficult it is to find them. But they're still out there. If you get the Wall Street Journal, you see bunches of them. Other financial publications, you'll see bunches of them. They're rectangular boxes. They look like an advertisement, but they are most definitely not. It's called a tombstone. And all a tombstone is allowed to do is say, here's the company. Here are the securities that it is going to sell. Here is the underwriting syndicate. That's all you can do. And at the top of it, there is a disclaimer. This is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation to purchase the securities noted below. Those securities may be purchased only via the prospectus, which is available from the underwriters, or something to that effect. In other words, you are saying... This ain't an advertising document. This is just an announcement that we're going to have, that you're about to see a public offering happen. In reality, it kind of is an advertisement. Why else would you be putting it up there? It's sort of like but you can't let it look like that. You cannot say that it's that. You have to say specifically that it is not that. So if I ask you on an exam or a quiz, which of these is a selling document? I say red herring. I say choose all of those, all of the below, that are a selling document. And I say red herring, prospectus, tombstone. Only one of those is a selling document. Even though we know damn well that the tombstone is an ad, and we really know that the red herring is a pre-solicitation for offer. Okay, now again, but know in reality that, yeah, the tombstone is a selling document. What drives me crazy is that I'd like to pull up, you keyword in Google, tombstone. Of course, you'll get a bunch of graveyards. Stock offering tombstone. Then you get them, But for the most part, those are weird tombstones for really odd kinds of securities. They don't show a lot of images of genuine tombstones. Believe me, though, if you pick up a Wall Street Journal and you open up and flip around, suddenly you'll see you can't miss them. They're that obvious tombstones are. Okay, now, Form S-1 is the classic 800-pound gorilla of public offerings. There are a couple of other forms you could file. There's the Form SB-1, and there's the Form SB-2. So these are small business offerings, limited in the amount of money you can raise. God, I don't even know anymore how much it is for those. I did an SB-1 once. I think it was $500 million for an SB-1. They're for small companies that qualify as small businesses. A little bit shorter on the required disclosures. I don't know. I'm not sure to this day I understand why you would do an SB1 instead of an S1, although the fees for an SB1 might be a little cheaper than for an S1. Know this, though, that you are going to need in this day and age, not like in my time, but in this day and age, you're going to need a row of lawyers, a battalion of accountants, and a whole bunch of other people who are professionals who know how to do this, and they are going to charge you unbelievable amounts of money to prepare this. That's why it's practically impossible to do today what I used to do in my day, is to bring little tiny companies public. It's practically impossible to do these days because of the fees that you have to pay to highly, highly expensive professionals instead of some hack like me. And there were a few others in the business in my time too. And we just did this because we knew how to do it. But fortunately, they chased us out of the business years ago. Okay, now, public offering. Understand, though, that that's not really even the end of it. It's all well and good to say that people can sell your stock after they've bought it, and new people can buy the stock in the secondary markets. But that means nothing if there isn't a market for it, which means that you're going to have to go through some other layer to get a trading symbol and a listing on an exchange. Now, the big exchanges are the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ, the NASD, National Association of Securities Dealers. The New York Stock Exchange, all of these have their own requirements. Whatever you have done for the SEC, mark my word, what these self-policing organizations, which these exchanges are, it's going to be worse by a mile in some cases. The NYSE standards for financial stability, the NYSE standards for paying money to them and all that is just a nightmare. Amex is a different kind of exchange in kind of a fundamental way, but it's still getting listed there. It's a real monster. I only once tapped into the Amex. For the most part, I did my work through the NASD to get companies listed on the NASDAQ, get them a trading symbol, get them listed. And the way we did it back in that, and I think it's still the same to this day, is the 15C211. It's a form that you fill out. It's like masses of financial information, technical information, a lot of disclosures. Some of it's the same things that would be in the selling document, but still, they want it for their purposes. I was under the gun of a compliance officer at the NASD named Claire. I mean, she was the biatch from hell. She abused me. I mean, after a while, I really liked that lady. I mean, I knew her grandkids. It was really creepy. I'd call her up, and she'd demean me and criticize me for a while, and then we'd get down to talking about family. But, man, she taught me how to do things, and she told me how to word things in special ways. Really cool stuff. Like, She was the one who taught me how you use the notes to the financial statement like a weapon. She said, everyone thinks it's the income statement and the balance sheet and the statement of cash flows and the statement of retained earnings. She said, you learn how to use those notes to the financial statement to tell the real story. And then no one can ever come back on you and say you didn't tell them the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And that was very cool, the way she worked that way. After she had abused me, then she'd teach me. And it was, I knew how to look at financial statements in a whole new way. And I also knew that when I taught accounting, or when I brought up accounting, somewhere along the way, I would tell you to have a look at those notes of the financial statement, because they are whispering truth to you that you might not find anywhere else in those financial statements. Anywhere else in those financial statements. Okay, but anyway, you work, and finally you got a trading symbol, and up it come. Now, the NASD is a thin market, mostly for riskier companies, small companies, and the NASD is not a physical trading platform. It's an electronic network. It's been around for ages. And essentially, a broker-dealer in one part of the country will have someone who wants to sell 100 shares of some obscure company. And then he'll put that up on the net, on this network. It's not the internet, it's a network of its own. And then other broker-dealers will kind of look at it and say, well, I've got someone who wants to buy 100 shares, or I don't have anybody, maybe I'll check with some of my clients and see if anyone wants to try the stock. It's that kind of a market. It's thin, it's nasty, and I found out very quickly that if you wanted to get a market maker, preferably a syndicate of market makers, in other words, broker-dealers, small brokerage houses who would play on your stock, you are going to have to give them a bunch of free stock. Well, we need some for inventory in case there's a big surge of buy. Bull crap. You just want to pile that stock so that you can put it on your assets and sell a bunch of it if the stock price ever does go up. The negotiations were bizarre in some cases. I had a company that was selling, it came out of the pink sheets. We brought it up to about a quarter a share. Now, there's a term in the trading. Back in the day, we didn't use decimals. We used increments of 1/16. So we would say, what's it going to take for a teenth? And a teenth, okay, you're going to have to get a buy surge in any 48-hour period of 10,000 shares, and we'll bump you a teenth. In other words, you were just struggling to get even a tiny bit of movement upward in a stock. Simply because if you're talking about the New York Stock Exchange, you've got hundreds of millions of shares being bought and sold. That's how you get major, like a dollar movement. But if you've got 10,000 shares being bought by someone, that'll drop you a teenth. If you have 10,000 shares sold without a matching buyer, that's going to drop you two or three teenths. So there's all of that part of the story, too. And it's actually kind of like I'm telling you about how you ride a horse and buggy. But still, some of that's still there. Okay, look. I need to make sure you know this right off the bat. I almost forgot. You're not just going to have to deal with the SEC. You are going to also have to deal with any states in which offers to sell or solicitations for offers to buy are going to occur. You're going to have to file parallel documents with the divisions of securities of such states as you choose to have your offering happen in. And you've got to be as careful as hell about that. Some states are historically known for being loosey-goosey. Other states are historically known for being tight-ass. Some states that used to be really easy states for registration of securities turned, because they didn't like the reputation anymore, turned into nightmares for registration. It's like a crazy quilt. But know that you have to be awfully careful. So, I have registered a stock offering with the SEC. I have registered that stock offering also in 38 states. You're not going to A lot of times you're not going to waste the money to register in a few states. Okay, well, you're in my class, and then afterwards I get to know you, and I figure out that you're not only a nice guy, but you're also an incredible sucker. So I'm going to try to sell some stock to you in an offering. It's registered in Illinois. Okay. Well, it turns out that you are a citizen of Idaho. You got a thing for potatoes. I don't know what it is. It's weird. But look, I can't, technically, offering and selling to you, the only thing I could do is say I did it in good faith because I thought he was a resident of Illinois. But technically, if I didn't register that in Idaho, which I probably wouldn't, I'm not supposed to sell it to you. So do know that the state divisions of securities are in there too. That was where I got into trouble. Now, I am past the statute of limitations, although there are still a few states that I don't go to on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, I probably never will set foot in those states again. But it was in the states that you got the real flack, because you'd have these ambitious regulators who, they were trying to make a name for themselves by cracking down on corporate crime or some crap like that, just like local prosecutors throw tons of idiots in prison showing how butch they are. It's a political thing. And you had a couple of states where you had some very ambitious politically minded compliance people who would come after anyone they could get their hands on. And I got targeted in two states especially. One of them, I was really close to a real bad experience. Fortunately, I got out of it because I convinced it was Utah, which used to be a Wild West. But then Utah turned real tight ass. And there was a regulator there. He had a master's degree in English. Somehow he got a job as a compliance officer in the Division of Securities in Utah. And oh, he thought I was the Antichrist. And he finally called me up one day to let me know he had me. We talked and we talked. And I actually convinced him. I knew a lot about it from some friends. And I convinced him that I was considering converting to Mormonism. I shit you not. We talked. You ever seen Richard Gere tap dance? Oh, I did it like a boss compared to. And I actually, the pressure came off me. He sent me a lot of Mormon literature. We talked two more times on the phone about the process of converting. For the love of God, you know. But at the same time, they never filed on me. Even though I probably could have gotten out from under it, I had enough political capital with good lawyers, I probably could have gotten out from it, but it still scared the hell out of me. And it was better to pretend I could be a Mormon than to go through that process and get extradited. But that is a true story, bro, and I am, to this day, I will not go to Utah. I will not go into the state. There's another state I won't go into either, but I will not go into that because that got really complicated. Okay, and it involved more than just securities. Okay, private placement. There are exemptions from registration. The Securities Act of 1933 governs the primary market, the selling of stock. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 governs the secondary market, where the stock is already out there bouncing around between and among investors. But under the Securities Act of 1934, thou shalt not sell securities without proper registration. You will not do it. Unless you do it in reliance. Unless you do it in reliance upon an exemption from registration. In other words, there are ways that you can actually sell stock without registering it with the SEC. Now, you still might have to do some kind of registration action with a state, but there are some classics. There are three under Regulation D. We call them Reg Ds. There is the 504, the 505, and the 506. The cool one is the 504, because you can sell under certain conditions, you can sell up to $1 million in stock, and that stock is freely tradable, but you don't have to file one of those forms with the SEC. You'll have to prepare some form paperwork to do it. And the states, many states have a uniform form. Oh my God, it's been so long since I have done these. It's form U, it's a U1 form, but there's an acronym name for it too, and it's escaping me right now. I'm not gonna hold you to it. But you fill out this form, and there are many states that'll say, okay, this form allows you to do this offering to our citizens in this state. There's, you got to know which states you could, that form is accepted in, and you file that with the state regulators. But the 504, you don't produce a prospectus. It is a selling document like a prospectus, but the name for it is offering circular. It's a prospectus for a little offering. And I prepared probably a dozen offering circulars in my time. The Reg D 504 is called the $1 million offering. The stock that comes out of it is freely tradable. But remember, you're going to still have to get a ticker symbol. And that was where Claire ate my ass, because I was bringing to her these little tiny companies that I was doing $1 million offerings on 504 in reliance on the exemption of Reg D 504. And so she was expecting that I was going to come up to full standards, like it was an SEC, a real live offering and all that. So I got out from under one realm of difficulty by not having to prepare a form SB1 or something like that, but I got my butt kicked at the NASD because she said, I'm not giving you a trading symbol until you show me that this is as good as any other company that went the full route with the SEC. Okay, fair enough. And I mean, offering circulars, I had them printed at a Kinko's, and then they were just simply distributed. No underwriting. You're not going to get a firm underwriting on an offering circular. But you can probably find investors who will buy them. You can solicit to people in certain ways. You don't have to worry about their sophistication as investors. And if you are okay with doing self-underwriting, in other words, the officers are selling it themselves, or maybe getting some broker-dealers involved in a best efforts underwriting, and that was the thing to us. You make the offering circular look classy enough, and then you send it to some small broker-dealers around the country. And I worked with a couple of houses. One was out in Spokane, and then was another one in Baltimore. Baltimore, was it? But anyway, they'd say, oh, well, this looks pretty good. Well, we're not going to commit to anything, but we'll try to sell some of your stock. Oh, by the way, send us 10,000 shares free, and then we'll help you. Okay. Oh, well, anyway. So the 504 actually generates freely tradable stock. You can raise only up to $1 million on it, but it's actually kind of a way to get public, to go public, without the benefit of a full-blown nightmare registration statement. So this 504 is almost like a hybrid. These two, and then there's another one called the Reg A. The Reg D 505, the Reg D 506, and the Reg A. They generate restricted stock. As a general rule, the 505 and the 506 are, you can sell stock to sophisticated, knowledgeable investors without benefit of registration. The assumption being that they're smart enough that they should know to ask for the right documents to do their offerings and all of that. A lot of times in an angel investor kind of thing, you might see those on TV, those kinds of purchases of ownership interest in a company would be in reliance on a 506, super sophisticated investors. 505 and 506, you can actually, I'm talking from old rules here and they probably have changed, but what you can do is you can have one very sophisticated investor, And then you can bundle some less sophisticated investors under that one. If they know that person, you can actually kind of use one real smart, got a master's degree in finance, does stock brokering. He could be a seed investor, and then he could put under him, under his responsibility, a few other investors that could put some money into stock in the company too. So you can do tricks like that with the 505 and the 506. But the 505 and the 506 do have limits on how much you can raise. At least the 505 does. The 506, Now, the Reg A. The Reg A is on $5 million, I think it was, in the old days it was $5 million. I don't know what it is now, but yeah, I'm just giving you the outline. A Reg A is a private placement. Offering circular, you can raise up to $5 million, and you can do it in a fairly general way. You don't have to have super sophisticated investors, but you have to meet some qualifications for it to be, to say, so the SEC calls you. Okay, we found out you're selling stock. Well, yes, in reliance upon exemption from registration under Regulation A. Oh, okay. Might be the end of it. So you can rely on an exemption not to file. The states are still going to probably kick your butt in some ways. Great example of an offering that was done in reliance upon a restriction, in reliance upon an exemption from registration. A beer company, some years back, wanted to expand its operations. It was recognized a lot of people were beginning to like this beer, and so they wanted to grow their brewery and be able to get some distribution centers going. They had the genius idea of, they said, let's do an offering relying on Regulation A, and the way we're going to get our people to know about this offering is we're going to put offering circulars right in the six packs of beer, bottled six packs. Just stuff it right in there. It was a huge success. You had all these good old boys, well, goddamn, look at this. Drunk off their asses, reading this offer, I could become an owner of my beer. It was a major success. They sold and sold and sold all that stock. They just kept selling. Money came rolling in. And then the SEC said, you got to give it all back now. Say what? Yeah, because the limit of this offering was $5 million and you were gathering. You just kept taking money. So now you got to give it all back, pay a massive fine, and start over again. Well, shit. It was one of those things where it was a brilliant idea. They were going to sell stock to their customers who loved the product, and you know, and it was not a big expensive thing. Unfortunately, they didn't understand. They didn't have legal counsel. They thought, well, we could just do this. This is America. You can do. Enterprise is free. No, it's not. They made a big blunder. They survived the blunder. They went back through the process. And interestingly, if I understand the story correctly, because it was such an incredible success, they got the attention of several serious investment bankers, you know, the kind that buy your stock for you, from you, and then sell it to the public in a real public offering. So there was a bright side to this because they had shown our stock sells. And so they got the attention of some of the big boys, and that company is around to this day, and it's a serious playa at the high level in the beer industry to this day. These are the exemptions from registration. Note this. You cannot sell stock. There was an offering, a company out in San Francisco. They wanted to sell $5 million in bonds. That's a security. You have to register. In other words, note that it's not just common stock. You have to register. It's any security. So, security, and they were harping on me because we want you to get this thing ready to go. We're ready for this money. We have people who will lend us this $5 million, buy these bonds that we are selling. So we're ready to go. And I go, well, the SEC isn't ready to go with you. First of all, you haven't paid me a damn dime. And second of all, I'm preparing the documents, but you're not going to get to have them say, go ahead, sell the stock. You're going to have it qualified, and then you're going to have a quiet period, the whole nine yards. You can't just charge out there. Well, I got a call one night from a reporter. Yeah, a company official said for us to call you. You're the consultant on this offering of bonds that was sold out this morning. Huh? And, you know, you're on the phone, and you're still wanting to put on nose glasses. You know, no, I don't know anything about this company. So I called him, called the president of the company up. I said, you can't sell unregistered securities and non-exempt transactions. And he said, watch me. They spent some time in prison. I ratted on their asses. But anyway. Now, there are other kinds of animals, you know, that I haven't talked about in this class yet that represent possible ownership. One of them is a warrant. A warrant is a right, but not an obligation, to purchase stock of a company. So I might have a company that is the stock, the common stock, price of the common stock right now is $2 a share. Shows you what market I worked in. Yes, penny stocks. Okay. And they might decide, well, we're going to sell a warrant that strikes at $3.50 a share. What that would mean is that the owner of the warrant would be allowed to buy a share of stock from the company at $3.50 regardless of the actual stock price. You see that this warrant isn't worth hardly anything at all unless the stock goes to, let's say, $6. And suddenly that warrant is worth a lot of money. It's like a bet. An upside bet. And you can sell. There are companies that sell warrants. I mean, you're not going to get a lot of money for a warrant, especially a warrant that is out of the money. But at the same time, it's a way to bring together some money. And ultimately, if the company does do well and the stock does go up, you've already registered these warrants and the money just starts coming in, people exercising their warrants. Now, something the book doesn't tell you about, which was a trick that I learned, I was taught how to pull this trick, and I did it in three different offerings. Instead of selling common stock, which, this company wanted to sell its common stock at $7 a share. That was going to be a pretty damn hard sell. I mean, valuation-wise, you're probably talking no more than $5 a share on a good day with rosy glasses on. But they want to sell stock at $5 a share. I said, okay, let's talk. What if we make it, instead of a stock offering, we make it a unit offering? The buyer is buying a unit which comprises one share of common stock, one warrant striking at $8.50, and one warrant way out of the money striking at $11. So that it's like a sweetener. There's hardly any value to them in and of themselves. But if there is potential upside and the investors see it, they will see, yeah, I'm kind of overpaying a little bit for this one stock, for the share of stock, but I'm getting these side bets. I get first dibs. If the stock does go up in price, I can buy the stock price. Let's say the stock price pops overnight to $10. Well, I can walk in and just pocket $1.50 by exercising my warrant. And if the stock really keeps going up, I've got this warrant here at 11. If the stock pops to 15, I can pocket $4 by simply flipping the warrant. Yeah. The money goes to the money goes to the, yeah. The people say to the company, I have the stock price is $10 a share. And the company will simply say, and the guy will say, okay, I have this warrant that gives me the right to a share of stock for $8.50. Here's a check for $8.50. Please give me my stock. Then you get that stock and you sell it right away for a little more. Yeah, that's paid in capital. Now, one thing that you will see is that if you look at stock market, tickers and all that kind of stuff, most people think a ticker, that stream of tickers, is all stocks. If you're looking at a real legit ticker, it's got lots of things that aren't common stock. As a matter of fact, warrants have their own fan club. Now, if you file the registration statement or rely on an exemption of some kind, you can actually have warrants that are part that become traded on exchanges. You might have an out-of-the-money warrant that actually has an active market for it, because if there are investors who want to bear that risk, they'll buy it from other ones. So here's something that I have to bring up to you about a term. Now, in this unit offering that this was not exactly what happened, but as far as the prices go. But in this offering, I made the warrants detachable. In other words, the warrants could actually be torn off and traded on their own as their own security. So in other words, the owner of the share of common stock didn't necessarily, over a period of time, have to be the owner of the warrants. Detachable warrants can be removed and sold separately as their own little securities in warrants market. Non-detachables, only the original owner of the stock. The stock, the warrants have to be owned by the same person who has the stock. You see, by making the warrants detachable, though, I made them more valuable because they could be traded on their own as opposed to something else. It was kind of a cool deal because in this company, the company drifted upward, and it, you know, even when the stock price was moving into the $8 range, those warrants were starting to show some life. 35 cents, 40 cents, they were trading because there was this potential for the stock to go up, so there was speculative buying of the warrants. And it's kind of fascinating to watch that because looking at the warrants was telling me what the market's thinking was about the future direction of the stock price. As the warrants started to show life as far as price appreciation, trading activity, that told me that investors were beginning to pay attention to the company and were beginning to see the possibility as higher and higher that the stock would go up in price down the road somewhere. Kind of an interesting thing to use the warrants for. They were almost like throwing out monitors into the ocean to see what the currents were up ahead of you, in a way. Those were kind of one of the things. Warrants are, again, you can see them. You can actually trade in warrants. There are warrants. There are people, they love warrants because they're sort of like betting tickets. They're like options. They're very much like call options in some ways. As a matter of fact, some executive compensation packages have warrants as part of the package. Now, you understand what the cool thing about a warrant in a package is. You're the CEO of my company. Well, we're going to pay you a kind of a lousy salary. And our stock price right now is $5 a share. We're going to give you 1 million warrants at $10 a share. Well, you see all the exciting incentive you have to drive that stock price to $20, $30, $40 a share? Because if you sit on those warrants and the stock price gets to, let's say, $10 a share, okay, let's say it goes to 30, to 50, you're sitting on those warrants and you say, okay, time for me to retire. Those warrants are worth, you have to pay $10 for a stock that is now worth $50 a share. So all you're going to do, you're not even going to go to the company. You'll probably just trade them in the secondary market or something, or you might go to the company, one way or the other, and suddenly you have a whole big buttload of money on you. They are a great way to create incentive. Instead of you sitting on your fat ass as the executive and collecting your salary for drilling this company into the ground, The only way you're going to become rich is if you make this company rich and its real stockholders out there rich. So there is a way to do it, is to use warrants. It's sort of like a carrot in front. Yoo-hoo, big boy, come and get this carrot. That means you have to work for your dinner instead of just being the typical executive of an American corporation. That's all I have for you. Go home.